Anyway, it's good to be with you this morning. Let me just say something to you all sitting in the back. Like the Apostle Paul, I've got a thorn in the flesh. And so this is not going to be a lecture. This is going to be interactive. So if any of you back there care to make a comment and you want me to actually hear what you say, you're going to need to move up a little closer. Now, if you don't want to make a comment, or you do and you don't care if I hear it, then that's fine. It's up to you, but I just thought I'd warn you a little bit about that. So we are going to be talking about the ABCs of discipleship, and believer and obeys the gospel. What is the word we most often use to describe that person? Christian, okay. Now, do you know how many times the word Christian is used in the Bible? You know? You know, ma'am? Okay. He said three. How many agree it's three? Okay. How many think it's actually 13? How many think it's one? How many don't know? How many don't want to vote? It's three. Only three times the word Christian is used in the Bible. Now, do you know, and this is an easy question if you think about why I'm asking it. Do you know what word is used in the Bible the most often to describe a Christian? Disciple. Yeah, okay, disciple. You might have guessed that since this is the title of the lesson. The word disciple is used some 240 times in the New Testament. And if you think about it, and the first time the word Christian is used, in Acts 11:26, and they were called Christians. Who were called Christians?
Disciples.
The disciples at Antioch. And so there you have the word disciples. The disciples were called Christians. John in his gospel uses the word disciple, or either singular or plural, 82 times. And so this word is used a lot. So I want us to think about this idea of being a disciple and what the word means and what this is all about. Bill Hull defines discipleship as the intentional training of disciples with accountability on the basis of loving relationships. And so you think about a lot of things in life that we are trained. If you go to the university and you're going to become an architect, you might become a disciple of Frank Lloyd Wright, you see, or whatever other discipline that a person is interested in, and it might be a mentor, a person that you become a disciple of, but you're being trained and you're following in that regard. So we're going to think about the ABCs of discipleship, and we're not going to go all the way to XYZ, as you can guess, in 3 days. Now, if I was here for a month, we might could go all the way to the bottom of the alphabet. So what we're going to do is each morning we're going to have qualities of discipleship. And so start with ABC. Now, Taylor mentioned the idea that we're doing something that is elementary. And I guess when you say ABCs, you are. And everything in life, really, when you think about it, there are elementary principles, aren't there? Now, if you were a mathematics major and you went into high school, and you were a math major, where do you think you would start if you were a math major? What, Taylor?
Addition.
Well, you might start that in elementary school. But you wouldn't start with calculus, would you? Right? That would be a course a little bit further down the road. It was under the old law when I was in high school, so it's been a long time ago. But we did algebra in freshman year, and then you went to geometry. And, you know, then you kind of graduate up to trigonometry, and then to calculus, and then calculus two. And I never got past geometry, and I only got to that because I promised the teacher I would never take another course under, and she passed me and let me out. And so I don't know. It's sort of my math career. But there's basics, right, that you start with. All right, you have football season that's underway. Do you know that even the professionals, when they go to training camp, They start out with the fundamentals. They do the fundamental drills. I know when I was playing basketball, and you start out every basketball season with real fundamental things about passing and dribbling, and you work on your two-hand chest pass and your bounce pass, and they coach you how the chairs out at the gym, and you practice dribbling around those chairs. And today they may use cones, or I don't know, who knows, maybe they got a computerized thing. But you still do fundamentals. The story is told that when Vince Lombardi took over the job of the Green Bay Packers, and they'd been terrible. They'd been a losing team. And the first team meeting, he said, "Now, gentlemen, the Green Bay Packers, we're going to emphasize fundamentals, and we're going to start with the very basics." And legend has it that Lombardi picked up a football, and he said, "Men, this is a football." You can't get much more basic than that, right? And one of his players raised his hand and said, "Coach, will you slow down? You're going too fast." Well, I don't want to go too fast, but every one of these points, we could take an entire lesson. So I was told I've got an hour, which I've already taken 10 minutes just to do the introduction. So we're going to have about 10 to 12 minutes, maybe tomorrow 15 on each one of these points. And so hopefully they give you something to think about in terms of that. So we're going to start with the A, and the A is attitude. The most basic thing you can say about a person has to do with their attitude. How would you define attitude? When I say attitude, what comes to your mind?
State of mind.
State of mind? All right, right. What else? Anybody? What is attitude? Yes, ma'am.
I talk loud, so you should be able to hear me.
What'd you say?
I think it's a person's, to me, their action and reaction to the circumstances in life.
Action and reaction
to their
circumstances in life. Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah, all that speaks to attitude. It's an outlook, point of view, mental frame of reference, the position one has toward a person, thing, or situation, or even circumstance. So all of that speaks to the issue of attitude. And as I said a moment ago, that's the most basic thing that you can say about an individual is their attitude. And the world understands that. William James, who some have called the father of modern human beings, can alter their lives by altering their attitudes of mind. The ancient Marcus Aurelius said, "A man's life for what his thoughts make of it." And Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "A man is what he thinks about all day long." And so all of this speaks to our outlook, our thinking, that sort of thing. Now, the Bible speaks of attitude. Now, if you're using the 1611 version of the King James or even the New King James, the word attitude may not be used. In this passage, it will use the word mind, have this mind, and you've heard it quoted that way. But almost all the newer English translations, ESV and others, translate this, because that's what it's talking about. Having the mind of Christ is the attitude of Christ. So if we have the attitude of Christ, what do we have then based on definition? We have what? His what? Talk to me. Come on. Huh?
Point of view.
We have the point of view that Jesus had toward things. His outlook. His mental frame of reference. About what? Everything. Right? You said the circumstances of life. And so toward people and situations and toward God and toward spiritual things. And so he's our example. Of course, we know that Peter said that he's our example to follow, walk in his steps. So here's a simple passage, and we'll come back to that more in just a second. But think about that. So when you look at a disciple, and I'm not sure, did I skip over defining? I mentioned a bit, but let's stop there a second. A disciple is a learner. What other word can we use for disciple besides learner?
Follower.
A follower? Good. What else?
Student.
A student. And a synonym of student would be?
A pupil.
I think I heard that. Pupil, someone say. And so you have a disciple, a learner, a pupil. John 6 and verse 45 may have that in your notes, said, it is written that they shall all be taught of God. Therefore, everyone who has heard and learned from the Father comes to me. So here is one that's eager to learn. He hears, he learns, he comes. That's a disciple. That's what a disciple is all about. And that's fundamental. Now, he's not only eager to learn, he's willing to be trained. Okay? Luke 6 verse 40, Jesus said, a disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone who is perfectly trained will be like his teacher. Now, I used a sports analogy a while ago. That's why you see sports teams take on the character of their coach. Interesting how that takes place. And you can do, you know, I'm more of a basketball fan than a football. See, when I was growing up in Indiana, no one cared about football much, really, back in the 60s. In fact, my little high school, Cascade, didn't even have a football team back in the States. It was all about basketball. See? And so you can't learn that. You learn that your coach expects certain things. He expects you to talk in a certain way. You ever notice, like, especially at college ranks, they interview a player, and he will almost mimic a lot of times the kind of coach speak that you hear their coach say. Now, I want to be a little careful. I don't want anybody to think ill of me here right off the bat. But when I was a kid growing up, I was a Purdue basketball fan. And Terry Dischinger played for Purdue, and Rick Mount, Billy Keller, and they had some great players. But as I got a little older, you know, like the Apostle Paul said, when I became a man, I put away childish things. I became more of an IU fan when Bob Knight came to IU. Now, am I okay? Oh, you just coming up here to be close to me? Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you. So, but if you think about how, of course, he was such an enigma, mannered and well-behaved that you could ever think of. Knight wasn't always that way. But when they were interviewed, I mean, it was like they were mimicking Bob Knight. And the things that they had to say about their play and about their game and all of that sort of thing. And you just saw that. And their style of play. And if they didn't mimic what he wanted, they sat on the bench. Now, we understand that in sports. We understand that in a lot of different things. So a disciple is not above his teacher. And if we're going to be perfectly trained, we're going to be like our teacher. Well, more importantly than an athletic contest or being on a sports team is being a Christian and being a disciple of Christ. And so if we're really going to be discipled, then we need to be like Christ and we need to follow him. One other thing, I probably don't have this in your notes, but it's probably worth writing it down, that discipleship is not an event, it's a process. Discipleship is not an event, it's a process. Now, what is baptism? Based on that definition, what is baptism? An event that happens once, right? So you're baptized. But does that make you a disciple? Are you discipled once you come out of the baptistry? You have a wedding ceremony that happens once. At least it's supposed to only happen once, okay? So it happens once, but how long does it take to build a marriage? Anybody know?
A lifetime.
You know what? Norma Jean and I have been married 53 years. I'm still being discipled as a husband. I'm still learning. You ladies are all relating to that, I see. All right? Hopefully you're still being discipled. You're 44. Okay, well, you just got to keep at it. You know, you think when you get 50 years in that you get, but you keep learning. You see, you just... What do you think about that, Taylor? How long have you been married?
10.
Oh, you're just...
Long way to go.
You got a long way to go. And we just keep... It's a process. Marriage is a process. So is Christianity. It's a process. All right. And we're a fervent follower, and we've already talked about that. All right. And I got two other points. I got to move through this to get through the ABC. So Jesus called his disciples, then come follow me. And today he calls us, not in a miraculous way, but he calls us through the word. Come follow me, doesn't he? Now, let's think about, someone turn to Philippians, with all of you, turn to Philippians 2. And we're going to read verses 5 through 8, okay? Philippians 2, 5 through 8, all right? Do I have a reader, someone like to read that? Yes, sir.
Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross.
All right, so there he says that we have the attitude of Christ, and then there's some descriptive things about Christ. So how would you, I'm going to give you some specific points because you got blanks there, but just as an overview, what do you get out of that about the attitude of Christ? How would you describe from those three verses the attitude of Christ? Anybody? Talk to me.
Humble.
Humble, thank you. All right, good. What else?
Obedient.
Obedient, thank you.
Bondservant.
He was a bondservant. Good. What else?
He wanted to do whatever God wanted him to do.
Okay, yeah. He submit himself to the will of God to do what God wanted. All right. So what was Jesus' attitude? Oh, and this is just another way to say pretty much what everybody's already said. He was submissive. He was selfless. He was servile. Sacrificial. And we would sum all of that up, everything we've said, with one word. His attitude was spiritual. Right? Now, hey, that's a whole lesson. Taylor, you can take those 5 points. And they're preacher points because you got alliteration. And you're always a better preacher when you use alliteration. All right? But, I mean, you can just really camp on those. A lot of examples in the four Gospels, in the biographies, that you could look at and you can see Jesus' attitude. So, the ABCs of discipleship starts with the A and attitude. Ephesians 4 says, put off the old man, verses 22 and 23, and be made new in the attitude of your minds. Be made new in the attitude of your minds. So we put off the old man. The old attitudes, the old way of thinking, the old outlooks about things, and we're made new in our attitude. Yes, sir?
I was thinking about Romans 12, too.
Yes, sir?
Your idea of being progressive was there's a renewal of the mind that's supposed to take place.
Absolutely. But you're transformed, and that's an attitudinal change. All right, does anybody have a... We're doing really good, by the way, here on time, it looks like. Tell them we're busy, okay? Anybody have a comment or question or... a thought that you'd like to share about attitude and the fundamental of being discipled with the attitude of Christ? Anybody? Okay. Then B is going to be bears burdens. And you think about it, turn to Galatians chapter 6. Now, you're going to see pretty quickly, this lady, what's your name, ma'am? Anita, yeah. That's my second thorn in the flesh sometimes, yeah. But Anita said she already had all the blanks filled in for class. Okay. Anita's smart. But usually someone, and it's fine if you do this, you can tell me tomorrow what the C, D, and E are. But people like to guess when you do this, like, okay, I wonder what this is going to be if you were guessing. So I don't know what you guessed for the B. But when I was thinking about fundamentals, I mean, there's so many things in the Bible that speak to us about Christians bearing burdens. And, of course, you have this passage here in Galatians 6. Brethren, if a man's overtaken in any trespass, you that are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of gentleness. Considering yourself, lest you also be tempted, bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. So I think that's pretty fundamental, that disciples bear one another's burdens, okay? Now, you think about the word burden. A burden is a weight, and it's anything that is pressing one down physically. It is that which makes demands on one's resources, whether they are material or physical or spiritual. And so you have this burden. I alluded to this yesterday in one of the lessons. Verse 5 said, each one shall bear his own burden. Now, the New King James says load, and probably the reason why the translators do that is actually a different Greek word. And there, the word load or burden, whichever version you have in verse 5, refers to like a soldier's backpack. And so if you're a soldier, I mean, every soldier's got to put on his own equipment, right? And you got to be responsible for that. But the word burden in verse 2 speaks of a weight. And the word is used in different places in the Gospels where it took different people to bear a load, a burden. The one person couldn't do it. And we've all been there, haven't we? That something is too heavy for one person to carry. But you get two or three people to carry it, it lightens the load, and you're able to do it. And so this is exactly what is being talked about there. Now, we got that. So, let's just brainstorm this a minute. And I got some blanks here. I'm going to give you what have I got, about 4 points there. But what comes to your mind when you think about bearing burdens? I'd just like to hear your thoughts a moment. As you think about fulfilling this passage, what comes to your mind about how we bear one another's burdens? Anybody? Yes?
Well, Christianity is not about just you and God. It's clearly about other people, one another. Included, so I have to care about other people.
Exactly. Christianity is not just about you and God. It is about you and God, but not just about it. It's about the people and the relationships that we sustain to other people. So that's right. Yes, sir. Oh, I thought you raised your hand up.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
When the first thing that comes to my mind when I think about a burden is grief.
It's what?
Grief.
Grief.
Someone needs help bearing the burden of loss.
Mm-hmm. Okay, absolutely. All right, what else? Jack?
Well, one way of thinking about this would be Romans 12:15, weep with those who weep, mm-hmm. I think pertains to the last idea, but also when you're helping someone else bear burdens, you're helping them overcome temptations and the potential for sin, or helping them repent of sins in their lives.
Okay. Okay, exactly. All right, good. Good thoughts. Yes, Taylor.
There's this thing a little bit about like Matthew 9, where Jesus talks to the 12, send them out, and then after that, he's in a couple of chapters, he's going to give the invitation so that everybody who's weary and heavy laden. And it points out that Jesus saw the people, like there was an awareness on his part that they were burdened. And so I think some of that even starts with being willing to look and listen at people and listen to people to know what it is that they're dealing with in the first place.
Okay, very good, very good. Right. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
Physical needs. Some people have their own.
Okay.
And sometimes they need help with those things.
Okay. Good. That's fine. Yes, sir.
If I can use the Greek again.
You what?
If I can use the Greek again.
Yes.
Parakaleo, come mm-hmm. alongside, mm-hmm. encourage, comfort,
yeah.
That kind of thing. Just be there for somebody, even if you just never say a word.
Yeah.
Just to come alongside them.
That's the word translated sometimes, helper, and it's used of the Holy Spirit, parakletos, so to come alongside someone. And so that's what we're doing. All right, very good. Great thoughts. Well, let's talk about those. And most of them, I think, that you've alluded to or even specifically mentioned, we're going to talk about a little bit. You mentioned the burden of material want by helping the needy. Now, you think about some of the examples in the book of Acts. one of the first ones that comes to my mind would be right after the church began. And of course, you have all these people that come to Jerusalem for the feast day, and 3,000 are converted men, and then the number goes to 5,000. And it's implied, probably, that a number of people stayed on for at least a period of time, and now you have people with needs. So do you remember in Acts 4 what the brethren did to be able to meet those physical needs of people that have material and physical needs? Yes, sir.
They gave so that each person's burden was met.
They did give, and they did meet each burden. You might remember specifically what some of them actually did to do that. Yes, ma'am.
They sold what they had and shared it with the ones who had need.
They sold properties. So they sold, and they took the proceeds and brought it to the apostles to be able to distribute to meet those needs. Boy, you think about that, and I don't think human nature basically has changed too much. Times have changed, technology's changed, you know, culture, a lot of things, but human nature is pretty much the same. You think about having a need so great that you bought a piece of property over here that you're expecting to reap a big return on. Maybe you heard the interstate's coming through. Down in Florida where I'm at, we've got the Suncoast Parkway is slowly, over the years, moving its way north. And so they're getting ready to open another 13-mile section up where I live around Crystal River. So I was at a Rotary meeting the other day, and the Chamber of Commerce was talking about one of the exits. There was nothing there. It's kind of hard to believe they got an exit. I guess there's maybe subdivisions they're anticipating. But anyway, but they were talking about businesses and restaurants that's going to come in, and the guy, the head of the chamber, said that someone had bought 150 acres ahead of time. I don't know how long he's had it, knowing that the route of that road. And guess what? He's quite willing to let it be sold for development right now. It'd be interesting to find out what kind of profit's going to be on that 150 acres. But can you imagine if you're a Christian owning that 150 acres that is ripe for big time profit and development, and there's a huge need in the church, and you sell that and you take that money and just give it to the needy? I mean, that's what they did. And you talk about the attitude. By the way, all of these, the rest of these B, C, D, E, C are going to be predicated on the first one. That's why I chose attitude, because everything is about attitude. See, our point of view, our toward burden of bearing burdens on this might be, well, wait a minute. What? Didn't they have 6 months savings? You know, you're supposed to have 6 months savings, right? I mean, you've all read that, haven't you? See? And I've been in men's business meetings where a need would come up. Maybe a man dies or he's out of, and someone, one brother said, well, didn't he have insurance? Why do we need to dip into the treasury? Didn't he have insurance? And didn't they have any savings? And didn't they, what about this? Well, we need to be a little careful about our attitude toward bearing others' burdens that have physical needs. Then you come down to Acts 6, and you have the Grecian widows that are neglected, you remember. And there was a murmuring, a dispute that arose about that, that there might be some prejudice and neglecting those. And so the apostles just dropped everything. They quit preaching and teaching, and they just jumped in and rolled up their sleeves and went to work meeting those needs, right? Oh, did I forget? What? What?
Appointed other men.
Well, why? Were they too good to get roll up their sleeves and get their hands dirty? What's that?
They were working on something more important.
Yeah. And there's a great lesson there for us about delegation and about priorities. God has served tables. We have a ministry. And interestingly, the word ministry is used there twice in two different ways. One, their ministry of the word, but then also the ministering that has to do with benevolent needs, physical needs. And so they appointed seven men, which most people tend to believe that this is the forerunner of deacons, the word, the Greek word there is diakonos, that's used deacon in Timothy, and that these men took care of their physical needs. So we have examples, ample examples, helping us. The same Galatian text in Galatians 6 and verse 10, as we therefore have opportunity, let us do good to all people, and especially those who belong to the family of believers. And so what should the attitude of Christian be even toward non-Christians that have needs? If you're able, help them. So to do that depends on, one, is the ability, right? And then the second would be, what is specific said in the verse? What else? What is the other contingent on helping someone?
We have to be aware of it.
Yeah, the awareness or opportunity is we have opportunity. And so there's an awareness, and so an opportunity presents itself. We have the ability to do it, and so we do it. Now, most of us, we get a lot, you get a lot of requests, for needs, right? And so most, in fact, even if you're Bill Gates, I'm sure he gets offers he has to turn down, requests he has to turn down, because even a guy that rich, there's a limit. See, you can't do everything for everybody. And we all have different things, things that we believe in, and different needs that we see. And I may have an opportunity and see a need that you don't even never know anything about. And if I see that need and believe it's a worthy need, then I can do something about that. I don't have to get anybody's permission if it's my money, right? And I can contribute to that and help that, and right? And you the same. But then he says there, not only all people, but especially those who belong to the family of believers. So that tells me that if there's two situations of a neighbor that has a need and then a brother in Christ that has a need, and I've only got X number of dollars, that where should my priority go according to that verse? If I understand the verse right, especially those who belong to the family of believers. Now, that didn't mean I don't care about the neighbor. And it might be that out of that 20 bucks I have, that I give the neighbor 5 and the brother 15. I don't know. I divvy that up in some way. But the point is that there is a priority there, especially my own family. And I liken that to, I always tell the college kids down in Tampa, I said, now I love you guys, and I'll do anything I can for you, but I'm not showing my own kids. All right? And so I got to take care of their tuition because it's my family. It's my kids. Now, I might reach the point with discretionary income that I could afford both to pay my kids' tuition and their tuition, right? And there might be an opportunity of a kid that is not, doesn't have anybody to help him. And I can do that. Well, that's a wonderful opportunity, isn't it? And if I have the resources, then that's fine. So a lot of things come into play, you see, when we think about that. Well, we need to move on or we won't get through the B. The burden of sin. Someone said that a while ago, I think. And the context of this, and probably the immediate context, is really referring to bearing the burden of restoring the erring. Because he says if a brother is overtaken in a fault, that those that are spiritual... There is a, what is the danger sometimes for those of us that consider ourselves very spiritually minded and we see a brother overtaken in a fault? What is the danger we face? And we know the danger they face because they have been ensnared. And the trespass is the idea of being caught in a trap. What is the danger we face? Yes, sir. We might be caught in the same trap. All right. What would be another danger? Yes, sir. Okay, maybe we're not as spiritual as we think we are. That we have thought of ourselves more than we ought to think. And so we're trying to help someone and we got a greater fault. But let's say that we are as spiritual as we think we are. We're very spiritually minded. And here's a brother overtaking a fault. And we have the spiritual insight and wherewithal to help this person. What is the danger? Yes, ma'am.
We got to be careful we don't become judgmental or
All right, we got to become careful that we don't become hypercritical of this brother and say, I don't understand why in the world they got caught up in that. What's wrong with them? Don't they know better? They've been taught better? They've heard preaching? I know their parents. I know their grandparents. I just can't believe they'd do that. You know, I can remember as a kid growing up, you know, kids get in trouble, different things. And, you know, unfortunately, sometimes parents will say hurtful things like, well, my daughter would never do that. My son would never do that. And I remember my mom, someone had called my mom one time, and I overheard her end of the conversation, and they must have been said, well, I'm not going to say what my son might do because I don't know. Well, at first, that kind of hurt my feelings a little bit that mom thought I might do something bad, but then I realized that she understood that I have a choice to make. And they taught me right from wrong, and that I knew what I ought to do, and if I didn't do it, it wasn't her fault. And that she wasn't going to be judgmental toward this, which is really what she was trying to say, toward these other parents that probably had taught their kids. So we've got to be careful that we don't fall into that trap of seeking to restore the erring. And maybe become prideful that we are better than other people. All right, and then there's the burden of doubt by giving encouragement. Now, this is one we don't like to talk about. I don't think this was brought up because we're not supposed to have doubts. Isn't that right? In the Lord's church, we're not supposed to have doubts. And I think, ladies and gentlemen, we have done a disservice sometimes, and especially to good young people that have been brought up right, and they've gone to Bible class, and they got godly parents, and so they go to IU, or they go to Purdue, or Ball State, or wherever, and they have a philosophy class where the teacher is an atheist or an infidel, or a science class where the professor is an evolutionist. And even back when I was going to University of South Florida, I remember a literature class, of all things, where the professor, the very first day, had to say in such a snide and arrogant way, well, I hope there's none of you in here that believe that garbage in the book of Genesis. I'll never forget that. In a literature class. And I noticed as we went through that, that every piece of poetry or prose that had any kind of a spiritual aspect to it by any writer, that was the worst piece they'd ever written. That was terrible. But then you take something that he believed had a phallic symbol in it or had some kind of a worldly application. Oh, this is a wonderful. Oh, this is deep and insightful. Some of their best writing. And that's the way that professor was. Well, can you imagine if your children or grandchildren are subjected to very many classes that they might come home at Christmas break and raise some doubts, you know, about did God really create everything? About evolution? About can we believe the Bible? And people parrot things, you know, even professors sometimes. Bible's full of errors. You ever had someone say that? The Bible's full of errors. You know what I do when they say that? I say, really? I said, well, name one. Most people can't name one. Not as they say up in Norma's part of the woods, not nary a one. You know, because they've heard somebody say that, and they parrot that. So what we need to understand is that people can have legitimate doubts. And rather than belittling them, or, you know, writing them off as what's wrong with you, why aren't you stronger? We bear the burden. We give encouragement. We give evidence. We provide spiritual support, you see, when they encourage times of doubt. Anybody got a question or comment or thought up to this point? And someone did say this a minute ago about bearing the burden of sorrow by providing comfort. And certainly that's something that we need. I know when I first started preaching, and you're called upon to go to someone's home where there's been a death, or you to preach a funeral or go to the funeral home, and you don't know what to say. And I sort of learned that it's not necessarily what you say, it's just being there. It's that paracletos coming up alongside someone. You know, for all the faults that Job's three friends had in their accusations, they did start off good. They sat there 7 days and didn't say a word. You know, and so sometimes you just go and you sit down with someone and put your arm around them, hold their hand, and you're just there. And you don't have to say anything. And you're bearing a burden, aren't you, of their grief and of their sorrow. Jack mentioned Romans 12:15, I think, a minute ago, to weep with those that weep. And that's a challenge sometimes. George Bernard Shaw said the worst sin toward our fellow creatures is not to hate them, but to be indifferent toward them. That, he said, is the essence of inhumanity. And so when we fail to see as disciples the need to bear one another's burdens, and we just kind of shrug our shoulders, we become indifferent toward the legitimate needs of other people. All right, we got 15 minutes for the C. Anybody got any questions to the A and the B? Anybody? Good? Everybody good? All right. How's those headphones working, by the way? Can you hear me? Oh, good. All right. All right. I figured you could, or you'd be raising your hand. All right, that's good. What'd you say? No, I'm just kidding. All right. The C is going to be character. That disciples cultivate character. Now, what is character? What do we mean by character? Now, sometimes we will say, boy, he's a character. Now, we're using the word in a different way when we say that. But what do we mean by the virtue of character? Anybody? Jack, you look like you're wanting to say something.
Well, it has to do with the reputation, the personality, the manner in which a person shows up. I think those the attributes of the person that form their character, their presentation to others.
Okay, all right. That's pretty much a dictionary definition, what you said. The aggregate of features and traits that form the individual nature of a person or thing. And then it evolves, as Jack said, personality and just all kinds of aspects of who they are, you know, that make up the idea of character. Now, and it has to do with moral and ethical qualities, what would be some other words that are closely associated with character, as we define character that way? So just, I don't necessarily a wrong answer on this, hopefully some right answers, but what are some other words that we might identify as associated with character? Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, do you use values or morals?
All right, it speaks to the issue of values and morals that you have. Okay, what else? Yes, sir.
Integrity.
That's a great word. Integrity speaks to the issue of character. What else?
Temperament.
Did you say temperament?
Temperament.
Temperament, that speaks to the issue of character. What else? You said one a while ago in your first comment, and the word reputation is associated with the idea of character. Yes, sir?
How a person carries himself with different circumstances.
Okay, yeah. We know what you mean by that, how a person carries himself through different circumstances, how they deal with problems and situations, and it would be their response to those kind of issues. And really, you're even kind of speaking to the attitude that you have toward that, and the character comes through. Anybody else? Okay, I had integrity, honor, honesty, morality, reputation. I mean, all of those words speak. Character is what we would do, what he would do if he knew no one would ever be he'd never be found out. Okay. I think it was D.L. Moody that said that character is what you are in the dark. That speaks to the character. Mike Murdock, in a really good book about the leadership traits of Jesus, said this. And since we're thinking about being discipled, we come back again, remember, we're disciples of Christ, so we want to think about his character. Murdock said, Jesus never begged anyone to believe in him. He knew that integrity cannot be proven. It must be discerned. He never wasted time with critics. He kept his attention on his goal. He stayed focused. They accused Jesus of being filled with devils. He paid no attention. He simply continued to cast out devils. Look at this. Jesus never strived to look good. He simply was good. He did not labor to appear truthful. He was truthful. He never struggled to have a good reputation. He had character. And so I think that's a unique way of looking at Jesus and pinpoint a little bit about the character of Christ. There's a number of verses, depending on the version you use. This is one of the blessings of computers today, that I don't have to get out 27 Bibles and put them on my desk, that you can look at your Bible program. As a woman of noble character. Now, I think, based on your feedback from a minute ago, that we intrinsically know what that means about her. In fact, we not only know what it means, by saying that we know what it doesn't mean. Right? So if we say she's a woman of noble character, it doesn't mean that she was what?
A liar.
Yeah, a liar.
Yeah.
What?
Promiscuous.
Okay. There's no children here, so we can actually say promiscuous. Or as we used to say, a loose woman. She wasn't a loose woman, all right? She was a woman of noble character. So we know what it means, what it doesn't mean. Here's another one in Romans. Paul said, rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope. Oh boy, you could camp on that verse for a while, couldn't you? But just think about that, and I kind of would connect that with James. Count it all joy when produce patience, or other versions, I think, more correctly render the word there, endurance, which is the idea here. And if suffering produces endurance, then as you go through the suffering and you persevere through that suffering, then you develop character. Have you ever heard the statement that a man is made in a crisis? That's not really quite accurate, because really a man is revealed in a crisis. A man is made day by day, or a woman. You understand when I say man, and it's mankind. But a person is made day by day as they deal with the little problems and trials and temptations and issues of life. And as we deal with this, then all of this has a cumulative effect over a period of time to develop our character. And then when a real crisis comes, then we're able to meet it. And people are amazed. They said, wow, look at the way he dealt with that. Look at the way she faced that. And what they don't realize that is the impact of all these years of things that they have built up and stored inside themselves and endured, that has produced character. Maybe, you know, this just kind of hit me saying that. Maybe that's why we have such crisis in our nation today, that we've spent too many years of not developing character. Both in our political leaders, our religious leaders, and a lot of areas shown forth in a lot of places. Did you have a comment?
Just real quick, the idea of the attitude that somebody has comes right back into this, but also the idea of them being a disciple of Christ.
Yes.
Because the sufferings that we go through, if we don't respond to them right, it's not going to produce the right character.
Absolutely.
You know, so yeah. It's all based on the idea that you're following Christ.
Good observation, yeah. Some translations render 1 Corinthians 15:33, bad company corrupts good character. And that's true. See? That if you're around the wrong kind of people, it's going to have an impact on your character if you continually associate and you make those your closest friends. And then a great verse in Proverbs 31 about the woman whose price is far above rubies. And one version translates that a wife of noble character. Others say a virtuous woman. So there would be a word when you think of character, virtuous. A virtuous woman, a woman or a wife of noble character. So the goal of all Bible instruction, you see, ought to result in developing Christ-like character. I think it was D.L. Moody that said, God didn't give us the Bible to make us smarter sinners. And so if we're not careful, you see, in our Bible classes and in our hearing sermons and even in our private reading, that we can allow ourselves to accumulate a lot of facts. And so we say, you know, what happened on each day of creation? Name the 15 judges, list the 10 plagues. Now, I understand those things. We need to know the facts. And certainly with children's classes, you start with fundamental kind. But by the time we get to the adult class, I mean, when you got to do a fill-in-the-blank workbook and list the 10 plagues and go around the room and you can actually list them, I think that's a little bit beneath where we ought to be as adults, don't you? And just, you know, read a Bible verse and fill in the blank word from a Bible verse that's as clear as can be. The result ought to be a development of Christ-like character. And so it's not just to become proficient and academically have some academic achievement in the Bible, but it's to internalize impact, has an impact on our character. One writer says, character is never built in the classroom, but it is built in the circumstances of life. That's what our sister there back in the land of Goshen said a while ago, that it has to do with circumstances. Okay. All right, we got a minute or two left. I got a little story I want to tell you. Anybody got a wrap-up comment or question here about the ABCs? So the Russian comedian that you've heard of, Yakov Smirnoff, you know, when he first came to the United States, of course, he had for years a lot of jokes about how he wasn't prepared for life in the United States. And one of them, one of his skits he does that the products that are available, the instant products that are available in grocery stores. He said, on my first shopping trip, I saw powdered milk. And you just add water and you get milk. And then I saw powdered orange juice. And you just add water and you get orange juice. And then I went to the next aisle, and I saw baby powder, and I thought, my, what a country. Well, we can become spoiled in our country by the things that are instant. And if we're not careful, what we want, see, we want instant maturity. And so we're baptized, and you go to church, and you hear some sermons, and you do that a while, and bingo, you're mature Christian. But what does it take? Well, it's not instant. You see, remember what I said about discipleship a while ago? That it's not an event, it is a process. And so it takes effort and energy and requires commitment and it demands focus. And so there we have the ABCs. Yes, ma'am, you have a... Oh, I thought you were raising your hand. See, I'm kind of like an auctioneer. If you move or something, you buy. You know, I think you got something to add to that. All right, Taylor, do you have any closing comments for me just to wrap this up? Okay, if I can, let's just have a brief word of prayer. And we'll be dismissed. I hope you all can come back tonight. And I hope we can have a good steady and good crowd tonight. Thank you for coming this morning. Appreciate it. Father, we're grateful for the night's rest, for this new day, for the privilege and opportunity we have to reflect upon your word. And to think about these Bible basics of discipleship. We know that each of us are a product in the making, and we're all going through the process of learning and growing and becoming more conformed to the image of Christ and less of the things of the world around us. Bless us, Father, to that end, and help us in our study that we can not only learn these ABCs, but that we can indeed internalize them, and that we can become more like Christ in all that you would have us to be and to do. In his name we pray. Amen.